Welcome to the 10th and final this quarter COGSCI 200 on the temporal dynamics of learning. Today I'm happy to have my co-PI, Andrea Chiva, who's the head of the Interacting Memory Systems Network and also the co-director for science of this Temporal Dynamics and Learning Center, and she's also the one that does most of the work. Thanks, Andrea. Okay, take it away.
Which means more time on administration, less time on my talk. So I had grand ideas of doing sort of a wrap-up of the whole semester, sort of knowing what everyone does. But instead, I'm just going to talk about my own work like everyone else did. So of the many things we do that are relevant to temporal dynamics, I'm going to just take one example of how you can take something that's very important to many aspects of learning and bring it into a rodent model. Okay, most of the work we do in my laboratory involves rodent behavioral models. And as many of you already know, by this point in the quarter, sequences are absolutely essential to just about every aspect to learning. I mean, there are a couple things that are just pervasive. You can't get away from them: space and time. Every episode takes place in a particular space at a particular point in time. You can have all the parallel processing you want in the brain, but we're constrained by this external system that likes to do things sequentially. So things like speech end up being sequential in nature, and actions end up being sequential in nature. I'm interested in how independent events end up becoming slightly different, basically, or elements, if you will, by virtue of being part of a well-learned sequence. This takes place over time, often, and there's something fundamentally different about things once they become part of this sort of configural sequence, if you will, as opposed to individual elements. You've heard a lot about that in maybe even expertise learning, this maps onto. And for now, I feel like I have to have a conversation. I'm going to talk to you about this in the visuomotor realm. Visuomotor sequences are many of our daily actions. We look at the world about us. We act in the world. It may be that in order to get the laptop started up, I had to go through a particular action sequence to make it work. Often our actions are guided by the external world, and this is going to be the case in this rat sequence learning that I'm going to bring in. Now, why sequence learning? Like I say, the ability of a system to assemble events into a sequence is basic to a variety of cognitive and motor functions. Fluid behavior of a system relies on the eventual automation of such sequences. So if we always had elements, it would be a really inefficient biological system. It's better to automate. But there's also a cost to automation, and we'll talk about that. So we're going to take sequence learning into the brain. So first I want to tell you a little bit of the sort of biologist's point of view. The lesion work, as I always give the example, if you want to know how something works, the biologist's point of view is often kill it and find out what doesn't work. So there are several cases in which patients with damage to different brain areas have sequence learning deficits or temporal order memory deficits. Retrosplenial cortex, and I'll define these areas later. Sorry about that. I should have a slide first telling you where all these areas are for this particular crowd. But there is a location in the cortex, which I will show you on future slides, which is at the posterior aspect of the cingulate cortex. That's a gyrus that runs right on top of the corpus callosum. So if I were to slice here, lay this part of my brain open, go straight on top of the corpus callosum and follow it. You have anterior cingulate to posterior cingulate. Then the corpus callosum takes a kind of turn, and that turn is the splenium. Right behind that is the retrosplenial cortex, and that's the area I'm talking about here. There's a subset of patients that have damage to that area, and they have temporal disorientation. So they may remember events, but they cannot remember the order in which those events occurred. Early Alzheimer's patients also experience the same sort of temporal disorientation. patients and rodents with posterior hippocampus damage. And most of you have heard about the hippocampus right now. It's a subcortical structure that's implicated in learning and memory. Also have temporal order memory deficits, among other types of deficits. And prefrontal cortex damage has a variety of temporal and sequencing deficits. Patients with damage to that area amongst their working memory deficits, et cetera, also have a problem with things like duration estimation and maintaining the order of events for doing daily activities. For example, one of the things that they do with patients who have frontal damage in rehabilitation centers is try to teach them how to shop. And this should be a well-learned sequence, but on the other hand, they actually need rehabilitation, learning how it is you go about shopping, because there's a particular order to doing things that makes it more efficient. And these sorts of planning and sequencing tasks are difficult for these subjects. And of course, sequencing deficits are implicated in a variety of learning disabilities. Children with delayed frontal lobe development are often those children who have a difficult time with any sort of task that involves remembering sequences. This may be even things as simple as the little number drawings, 1 to 2 to 3, connect the dots, dot to dot was the word I was searching for there. And it may be more complex things that involve motor action sequences also, like tap dancing, karate class, etc. Okay, so a lot of you have heard, if you're talking about automated sequences, already in this class, many of you have heard a lot about the striatum in sequencing, the striatum in decision making, and particular subcomponents of the basal ganglia. I know Michael Franks was here talking and spoke a great deal about this. So there's this subcortical, quote, memory system that's thought to be involved in habit learning, and that involves the thalamic system, substantia nigra, dopaminergic input from the VTA, and the striatal system with cortex. So you have these corticothalamic striatal loops that sort of tune up, and eventually you get this automated behavior and sort of habitual behavior. And I won't go on with that because you had a lot of talks addressing just this sort of thing. And for those of you that forget what view this is actually sort of a smushed rodent view. Again, it's sagittal view, so if you take down here, look straight onto it. That's where the rodent striatum is. Okay, well, a lot of the details about this striatal system and the thalamic system are left out of the loop, so to speak. The cingulate cortices, which I was referring to, and in particularly that posterior aspect of the cingulate cortex, the retrosplenial cortex, is very much linked up in an inhibitory fashion and an excitatory fashion to striatal structures. Okay? In addition to getting independent input from the thalamus itself. Also, this structure, posterior cingulate, which also includes this most posterior aspect, retrosplenial cortex, gets direct input from the hippocampus, and in particular from the posterior aspect, the subiculum. Another thing that's not on this slide that's very interesting is that this structure also projects to the entorhinal cortex, which is one of the primary inputs of the hippocampus. So you hear a lot about independent systems, about sensory information from the thalamus, about this sort of striatal habit information coming in, and then people think about the hippocampus and entorhinal cortex as this sort of ongoing memory system. But what people often ignore is the fact that all of these are linked up in very interesting ways. And if you want to start to think about how things might be happening at what point in time, you want to think about what the interconnectivity is from these structures, because you have to have proper communication happening. And so processed in the hippocampus, amongst many things, you know about its role in things like episodic memory, is contextual information. What point in space or what object in space at what point in time, okay? You also have ongoing temporal information in the hippocampus also. And the point is, though, with all this information, at what point are things like behavioral output going to be encoded? So through these loops, you're getting sensory information, space and time information, and then there's a lot about computing in a commutative way, behavioral responding in the striatum. So it makes sense in many respects from the type of information being processed that these systems might be actually tuning one another up across time. All right, now this is an added piece of complexity, but I have to put it in here. So we're talking about the rodent system here again. We have another protracted sagittal view, and then larger in life, I have basal forebrain cholinergic nuclei. What's interesting about these, has anyone talked about neuromodulation? I guess Frank's talked a lot about dopamine. So we talked about dopamine as sort of a learning signal, right, and a reinforcement signal coming from the striatal system. What we didn't talk about at all in this class, I think, is the basal forebrain cholinergic system. In fact, some of the primate work that Paula Talal spoke about was originally taken to rodent work, and the root of some of the spike time dependent plasticity work in auditory cortex was actually based on cholinergic stimulation. So this is a region of the basal forebrain that is rich with cholinergic neurons. The cortex doesn't produce acetylcholine itself. It gets its acetylcholine from other sources, a series of brainstem nuclei, which aren't depicted here, and the basal forebrain. It's broken into several subnuclei, but there are a couple of limbs. The medial septum ventral diagonal band, which innervates primarily the hippocampus and cingulate cortex, and the nucleus basalis magnocellularis substantia nominata region, which innervates the entire cortical mantle, including the cingulate. So you see that there are some special areas. Actually, entorhinal cortex is one of those also, but I won't go into that. And that is, these regions of cortex, particularly the cingulate, going from the posterior aspect and a little bit to anterior also, receive dual innervation from this system. Well, what's interesting about this system, actually, there are timing signals going through this system. It's well known here that the medial septum input to the hippocampus sets theta rhythmicity and levels of theta rhythmicity, including the GABAergic input there also, but particularly the medial septum, sets theta rhythmicity in the hippocampus. What's interesting in my lab is that Lale Quinn actually discovered rhythmic activity in the nucleus basalis SI region, theta in particular, and beta, which is often in sync with the medial septum and other times out of phase. So there can be two independent timing mechanisms here actually projecting to region of cortex, so that you have two different rhythms being set up actually by these areas. Sometimes they cohere, sometimes they don't. And so that makes this a little bit special relative to other areas of cortex in that it gets both of these signals. Okay, well, let me just back up one second and say also interesting about these neurons here is the fact that they deteriorate in Alzheimer's disease. One of the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease is the loss, sudden loss of these magnocellular cholinergic neurons. So what's interesting about early Alzheimer's disease, actually one of the first signs of Alzheimer's disease is hypometabolism in the retrosplenial cortex, which is, now you have a sagittal human section. I've been showing them all this way, so you know this is rotated this way. Remember I say cingulate runs on top of the corpus callosum. You can actually see this corpus callosum is already thinned in this patient. there's the cingulate gyrus going from anterior, transitioning to posterior, and right behind the splenium is retrosplenial cortex. And so one of the very first areas to sort of break down is this area of the retrosplenial cortex. The yellow is areas of hypometabolism, basically.
So what does that do
when you're hypometabolic? When you're hypometabolic, it means that that region is not going to process as efficiently. So it's harder to activate it. Concurrent with that, actually, these same patients were tested by Leila DiToledo-Morell's group in Chicago on a visuomotor sequence task where they have to do actual self-ordered pointing to locations. Point in this location, repeat in that location, point a different location, repeat in that location. Even at the end of the quarter, I think I'm getting roughly the right pattern. Yesterday in class, I was the hallmark of frontal dysfunction, but today we've got the ordering at least. So anyway, these early Alzheimer's disease patients, this is self-ordered pointing is one of the first tasks to actually break down, and it's coincident with retrosplenial dysfunction. Actually, this was published at the same time independently. We were finding that this region is probably involved in sequencing in rodents. So it's quite interesting from that perspective. One other thing I want to point out then, some of the hypotheses that arose from the human work translated to rodent here is that there's some sort of cortical memory circuit then going from retrosplenial to through the cingulate gyrus to prefrontal cortex, that there's some association there, that this is the first to break down, and that that breaks down later in the disease. What's interesting about that, well, partly interesting is that this is reciprocally connected, remember, to the hippocampus also, forgetting about the other complex circuitry I showed you. And this is later what you see is hippocampal shrinkage, actually, going back into this. So the point I want to make here is that some of the disease models and lesion models point very strongly that the hypotheses regarding the role of the system in sequential behavior actually support this anatomical hypothesis. So in our lab, we want to go ahead and take the hypothesis that retrosplenial cortex contributes to encoding of sequential events into an animal model. And what we decided to do, there's a rodent in a chamber. We'll discuss that task in a moment. Rodents are a good model for this because you can actually take structures online, keep them online, and take them offline at particular points in learning. So what we did, with these rodents was actually go ahead and implant cannulae directly into the retrosplenial cortex such that we could inactivate that structure at a particular point in learning and see if sequential learning was disrupted at that point in time. We also needed to teach these rats to do a sequence task. And so we started fairly simply with a visual guided motor sequence task in which they were placed in these operant chambers. This is a little coarse actually here, sorry about that, in which there were several lights several holes, rather, where they could poke their nose in a back wall. And there was a light in the back of each of these holes. And when the light came on, the rat would be actually looking in this direction and would poke their nose into a hole. And then another light would come on, they'd poke it in that hole, and then they'd go to the back wall for food reward. And so here's a whole schematic of the task, actually, in which the rat learns to poke different holes. There's a sequence. And you can do the same sequence several times. And we call that a fixed sequence. So every other pattern will be the same sequence on a given day. And then you can also present lights in a random order every other time. So that's sort of an unexpected sequence. You have fixed, and then you have these random patterns. Oops, sorry. So I should have a movie there, and for some reason it's not showing up. And so I'm going to go ahead and just show it to you, if that's okay, because I think it lends a bit. Not good for the filming, though, sorry. Oh, do not install. No. Don't do that. All right, folks. Sorry. Okay. I'll just show it small. It's actually cleaner. Sorry. So I don't know if this is on your iPod playlist, but it's definitely on mine. So you can see that the rats get quite rapid at this. They go ahead and they poke into the four holes. And they'll actually begin to predict with the fixed sequence. They'll often get there before the hole even lights up. Let's see if we have an example of that there. No. There he did. Okay. Yeah, they do. And they get pretty good at not doing that because they're disciplined for that. They get a timeout where they don't get to go forward with the task. They have to sit in the dark for a little bit of time if they make premature nose pokes, and they learn not to, so they don't do it very often. Right, so what happens to accuracy and latency on the fixed and random sequences over time? Actually, day one, day two, day three, day four, day five, that's how long we run a particular sequence. That's one thing I was going to tell you, is there's several possible fixed sequences in these nine-hole chambers, and so we can run several different sequences across weeks. Okay, so 1 week we'll run one sequence, then give them a couple days off, then they'll learn another sequence, give them a couple days off, and so forth. Okay, there's also a fairly high degree of interference in these boxes because it's the same environment. So they really need to learn to be attentive to the sequence for that day, for that week also. So if you look at accuracy, this starts at 70%, just to point out that they're quite good at this task to begin with. For fixed and random sequences on day one, they're about equivalently accurate for the two. By day two, you can see they're beginning to split apart. So they're learning here. You can see evidence of learning, but they're not significantly different yet. And by day three, there's a split in the accuracy for fixed versus random sequences, such that there's a benefit for fixed sequences. Not too surprising. How about speed? They're pretty fast on these to begin with, actually. They got so good at these that it's hard to push the speed much faster. On day one, actually, they're slower for the fixed sequences. So this is interesting, actually. Because it looks as though, and you can see there's a larger degree of variability here also, and many of the rats really look as though they're trying to figure out some pattern, actually. They're trying to extract a pattern from the ongoing events in the world. Yeah?
Do the same rats do the fixed
and rainbow? Yeah. So I didn't point to that clearly, actually. Every other trial is fixed. And every other trial is random. So the trials are interleaved. So they'll do same sequence and then random sequence, same sequence, random sequence, and so forth for up to 100 trials a day. Okay? And so they also get faster At the same time, they're getting more accurate, which is very good, because you don't want accuracy. You don't want speed getting more slower, actually, with increased accuracy, or you have some different effect other than learning. So both speed and accuracy benefit across learning, and we see that there is some benefit to the pattern, that the patterns are being extracted. Okay. So, I'm sorry. No, it's okay. All right. So you can see that initial learning of this actually can be viewed as some sort of stimulus response learning, basically. You go from, but what happens is these get grouped across segments of learning. So here's where the aspect of the sequence comes in. Here's the reward, right? And you have one leading to two leading to three leading to four, and four leading to the reward at the end, right? Most rodent learning theorists actually will say that the only way that sequences build up is through what's called backwards chaining. So you chain backwards from the reward, such that the first association they would learn is four to the reward. Then they chain backwards to three, and then backwards to two, and backwards to one, and that's the point at which you have the sequence. What's interesting is that seems to be somewhat true, but it seems to also vary across time. And so one thing we were interested in looking at as a measure of sort of stimulus response learning and how automated the rats are at a particular point in time is when they were making interference errors. So here's what an interference error is, okay? What we did was look at random trials, okay, in which, let me take the example of the first light. The first light of the random trial started with the same first light as the fixed trial, okay? So if you're used to going, say, hole one to two on your fixed interval, and now you have a random trial that starts with hole one, if you are just doing everything randomly, it doesn't matter that you just did one to two. You'll just wait for the next light to come on and go to it. If, however, you already have this sort of sequential patterning going on, what you're going to do when you hit hole one on the random pattern is make an error and go to two. Does that make sense? So these we're calling interference errors. And there's a way in which you could call them actually ballistic errors, because there's a hint that if such and such occurs, you must go to the next step. They're so strongly associated. Yeah.
Okay.
And what I would say when I talked at first about the elements being sort of flexible versus being part of a configure, I would say the more sort of crystallized the sequence is when you're making these errors, also sort of a definition of automaticity from cigar rolling factories on back, actually. Yes.
Did they show any evidence of not wanting to do the first one? They're just worse at performing the first couple steps in a sequence, and later are better with the, because in monkeys that's definitely the case.
Oh, that they get more motivated at the end of the sequence because the reward's coming up. Yeah, I think initially, particularly once they get very good, it's rarely the case. Sometimes they'll perseverate on the food tray a little bit and wait to turn around for the first hole, but in general. Well, actually, you can see here that it happens in both cases, early and late, but there's an interesting transition, too. So a lot of the interference errors, remember, segment three is most proximal to the reward, and then it moves forward, okay? So if you look at day one on the fixed sequences, and you look at the interference errors, they're already showing, even though there's no benefit of the sequence on accuracy and latency, actually, there are automatic errors building up. And what's interesting is they aren't just backwards from the whole, like learning theorists would predict here. So there are a lot of interference errors on segment 3, which would be consistent with current theory. They're chaining backwards from the whole, but there are quite a few on segment 2 also, and there are fewer on segment 1 at this point. So this is somewhat consistent with theorists, but on day 1, given there's no benefit in performance, most would think that it's just segment 3 that would be ballistic at that point. Okay, day 2 is very interesting because there's a change in behavior and there seems to be a dip in interference errors, almost like there's some sort of processing change. Even though it's small, this is very reliable. Okay, and then what happens is they build up where the fewest number of automatic errors are actually in segment 2. And the most occur in segment 3 and segment 1, but quite equivalently. I would take this to mean actually that the sequence did go backwards from the reward, but it also goes forward from the first light also. So it isn't just backwards chaining, it's both forwards and backwards. So really, I think we do have an animal model of an actual sequence here, as opposed to simple backwards chaining. Which is good, actually, because people don't predict that animals would actually do that.
Yeah, but so I would think that day 2, you'd get consolidation from day 1, meaning they would have, you know, day 1, they're just learning it, and so there's no consolidation, so I would expect on day 2, there's better consolidation, so I'd expect more of these kinds of errors because they represent better learning.
Yeah, you would. And I actually think that they're different systems at that point. I need to bring this up. So, I mean, this is wild speculation. Okay, so hand-waving wild speculation. But I think what's actually occurring at this point, and if you watch the rats, it's interesting, actually, on day 1, they're a little bit slower. It's as though they're figuring something out, so to speak. On day 2, they get a little bit more rapid. It's almost like you're flipping back and forth from pure motor learning and actual recognition of here's a sequence. And if I were to analyze the video, and I should at some point, their scanning patterns are quite different. In day 1, it's sort of go, go, go with periods of hesitation. And then by day 2, they're sort of starting to pace a little bit. It's interesting. There are fewer interruptions in between, and there's definitely a difference in the performance that seems to be somewhat qualitative, but that hasn't been analyzed. Okay, so we chose day 2 as a time point in which we felt there was learning occurring, and we actually hypothesized that this would be a phase in which the animals were not yet completely automated, but were really beginning to recognize a sequence as a sequence of events. And this was the time point at which we felt that the retrosplenial cortex may be playing sort of a maximal role across early learning, actually, because we felt that the hippocampus was giving sort of time and space information into the retrosplenial cortex, which was then going back and tuning up the basal ganglia systems consistently over time. And in fact, when we inactivated with fixed sequences, and we obviously had an inactivation effect on both fixed and random sequences during early learning by infusing bupivacaine, which is a longer acting anesthetic, into the retrosplenial cortex. Now, this actually inactivates fibers as well. So it's like a local anesthetic into that region. More recently, we've done some inactivations that are just cellular inactivations that are pharmacologically selective. And we have 2 such animals, and we're building. And we actually get larger effects if we inactivate only the cells there. So even though this could be general to the cingulate bundle, we feel that it's probably a local effect based on a replication with another N of 2. Okay, so what happens with inactivation is that fixed sequence accuracy here are the vehicles, here are the inactivated animals, it drops significantly. Whereas random sequence accuracy, vehicles, inactivated, are relatively equivalent. And this is quite a consistent effect. It's not a huge effect in terms of percent accuracy. As you can see, what's happened is it's not like performance is dropping off, but that's good because their visuomotor function is still fine. What's happening is they're losing the benefit of the structure in the sequence on day two by virtue of not having that brain structure online. No, it's not like visually guided performance is dropping off, because random sequences are just right. So if random sequences dropped off, we could assume that they have impaired visual motor function.
I would actually expect random sequences to get better.
Because you would think ordinarily they'd be looking for structure in the random sequence, and that wouldn't...
No, because they'll make fewer commission errors.
Oh, right. On day two. Yeah, there should be.
I mean, that might happen more later.
Yeah, it should be slightly better for that reason. But later, actually, it doesn't have an effect at all.
And that's so, because this is involved in learning, not actually once you've got it learned.
Exactly. So thank you for the conclusion. So later, there's no effect. Fixed performance is better than random performance for both vehicles and inactivated animals. And once, exactly, we believe that the retrosplenial cortex is involved in tuning up the system, essentially, but once it's automated and they've got the sequence down, it does not play a role. So it's not like you have to have it online in order to perform this. There may be some benefit to some other aspect of behavior by virtue of having retrosplenial cortex online, but you don't get a benefit by having it online on day five of learning. So we think it's sort of an early tuning structure, kind of translating between the hippocampus and the basal ganglia with thalamic sensory input also. And the next stage was actually to go ahead and inactivate the basal ganglia at this time point, and we would expect actually that habitual sequence learning, and others have already shown this, would be impaired on day five. We would have a problem if we didn't replicate that in our particular behavior, but we're fairly, yeah.
Do you follow the ones that have been inactivated on day two? Do you keep training them?
And
do they show like latency
or anything? Yeah, they have a catch-up period actually. And then they're fine. Yeah, so it's as though they have to catch up on day two, on day three, but everything's moved over by one day, essentially.
So that region just stays
inactive
for a day?
Mm-hmm. Yep, one day. It's not even the full session, actually. So it's kind of cool, because if I were to show video, there's a point, bupivacaine only lasts for 40 minutes, and the rats perform for an hour, and at the end of each session, you can see the animal's performance begin to come slowly back online. So it's pretty cool, actually, because they were poor, everything looked random, and over time, as it begins to come back online, you see all of a sudden they're performing the fixed sequences better. Yeah?
Do they only perform one fixed sequence at a time? So it's just fixed random, or do you have any evidence they store something that they learned like weeks ago? And does it interfere when the first light is the same?
We don't look, but probably, you know, we should. It's a limited space. There's a high degree of interference. One thing we did was find that there are certain sequences that we just don't give the rats when we select fixed sequences because they're easier than the others, like directional sequences. We always switch direction in the sequences. That's one of the rules we give the computer in generating the fixed sequences, that you must switch direction. If we have unidirectional sequences, which we did once out of curiosity, that will actually interfere with everything. Yeah, they're very direction selective. So it's kind of interesting. So there are certain patterns that will be pervasive or learned much more rapidly and will show high degrees of interference throughout just about anything. So In conclusion, retrosplenial inactivations disrupt visuospatial sequence performance at an early but not a late stage of learning. These findings provide evidence for memory contributions of retrosplenial cortex in learning of new sequential information. What really interests us is this has sort of been a neglected region of the brain, even though it has a high degree of interface with all these systems. Posterior cingulate had a big life in the bunny literature a while back regarding early learning in certain aspects of conditioning, actually. And it never got picked up by other groups, despite the fact that the anatomy, as David Amaral put it, is golden. When I mentioned that we were looking at this area, Amaral said, oh, that area is golden, actually. It's good as gold. Because it receives primary hippocampal output, it projects to the entorhinal cortex, which is the primary entorhinal input, so it sort of completes the circuit there, and then it also completes the circuit regarding basal ganglia corticothalamic loops also, so it's this sort of interface. So from that perspective, we're interested in its early role. To step back, actually, and think about the system as a whole, and sort of zoom out on the big picture I was giving, what this demonstrates, and this is something should be somewhat evident but really hasn't been looked at, is you can't rely on just one structure in the brain to be the critical structure for sequence learning. For example, the basal ganglia have a reputation for being the critical structure in sequence learning. And that's true, actually. You have a very rough time retaining sequences, learning sequences without the basal ganglia, but they're not getting all the information directly, actually. They're tuned up by other systems. And these other systems play a role at different points in time. And the question that's very interesting to me is, what are the relationships between these structures by which one structure gets to predominate behavior at a particular point in time? So you can have lots of different structures active in the brain and interacting, but who gets to be critical for the output of behavior at a particular point in time? And in this case, early learning of sequences actually does require the integrity of the retrosplenial cortex. Later on, you can still perform those sequences. You can't learn new ones necessarily as efficiently, but you can still perform those sequences without the retrosplenial cortex. So learning and performance are not necessarily at all based on the same structures. And this is interesting because it might have to do also with the qualitative difference that occurs regarding how a particular stimulus is viewed by the brain when it's independent and when it's part of a sequence. And some of the things that we're interested in pursuing in the future in my lab are actually recording studies across multiple regions of the brain with structures inactivated and intact in awake behaving rats. So it's very ambitious. I'm sure it'll take 5 years to finish. But one of the fundamental questions we have is, what's different about a stimulus when it's part of a sequence and when it's not part of a sequence regarding different brain regions? How do they treat that stimulus? And so this task lends itself to that because you can look at the same light in a box and the exact same stimulus on a particular day when it's part of a sequence and when it's part of the random sequence to look for potential differences in processing in different brain regions. So that's one of the directions we're going. And we're also going to look at different rhythmicity and rhythmic phases of activity and how spikes may, I don't know if you are familiar with phase precession in the hippocampus, but that is over time, individual spikes in the hippocampus will begin to align to a particular phase of a rhythm that goes through the hippocampus. So learning includes aligning the spikes to that particular phase. And so we're have some hypotheses, and we're working with Yuri Basaki at Rutgers actually to develop more hypotheses about how it is that spikes might align to different rhythms across learning in this sort of a task also. So, oops, my acknowledgement slide's different. It's gone. That's why it's different. So let me just acknowledge people involved in this research. Thankfully, he was on the front front slide. So most of this work was painstakingly done by Chris Cordova, who was a graduate student of mine that recently finished and went on to McGill University. Now he's looking at intracellular recording in individual cholinergic neurons in awake behaving animals. So he has a passion for punishment. And right now in my lab, Lolly Quinn is following up on these studies and recording in these studies. So I'm going to stop there, actually, and save lots of time for questions. Thanks.
Question?
Oh, can I repeat the question? I was like, yes, I can. Would you like me to do that? All right. She asked if this area is preserved in people with hippocampal damage. Yes, because it's distal to the hippocampus, whereas the perirhinal and entorhinal cortices follow the hippocampus and the medial temporal lobes. This area is quite discrete from that. And so it is preserved. It is, however, disconnected from the hippocampus and the entorhinal cortex regarding memory. What's interesting is it remains in place regarding the thalamic connections and the basal ganglia connections. And amnesics can learn new motor sequences. Like HM did learn how to play the guitar. They do learn how to do this rotor rod tracing. And so visual motor type tasks, they do sort of automate. Eventually, they don't have conscious recollection that they understand that, and many people like Larry Squire would tell you that you need a hippocampus for that. So it's interesting because it seems like it can still independently play a role. Actually, one of the things I have to say, it wasn't just by chance of the architecture, but one of the things that interested in me in this structure years and years ago before the Alzheimer's finding was early testing of an amnesic subject when I was post-undergrad, not a grad student yet, who had total retrograde amnesia, but had reasonably good anterograde amnesia. She had lots and lots of hippocampal damage and should have been a dense amnesic based on the anatomy. She had an island of posterior hippocampus still intact and an island of entorhinal cortex, and it seemed like the only route by which there might still be communication possible based on what was intact is through the retrosplenial cortex. So it was at that point that I actually became interested in this anatomy. And later, when I became interested in the role of the hippocampus and time and timing in graduate school, that I started thinking about the interconnectivity, high degree of interconnectivity of the retrosplenial cortex with other areas. I actually never had a mentor who thought the area was remotely interesting at all. It was like every mentor I had, I was like, look at this area. Don't you think? I always worked in learning and memory. Don't you think this would be interesting? No. But actually, I had a graduate student, Chris, who wanted to go to the entorhinal cortex. And they said, you know, surgery is really difficult going to the entorhinal cortex. It's very deep in the brain. And if you're a millimeter off, then you kill the animal. So how about if we, what do you think about this area? And actually, he did get very, very interested. And what I didn't tell him is part of the reason no one had looked at that area in rodents is because it runs right underneath the sagittal sinus, which is the primary vasculature for the dump, actually, for the vasculature of the rodent. And if you're a quarter millimeter off, you kill the rat. So it is a difficult region to work on because of its proximity to the vasculature, but it's very interesting from that perspective. And one of the reasons we became interested in the idea of timing signals in there also had to do with this, like, why is this region special with dual cholinergic innervation? Well, maybe there are different rhythmic signals getting sent from these different structures. And in fact, when my postdoc went in and looked at the SI, in fact, there were times of different rhythmicity in one cholinergic nuclei versus the other. So it sort of completed the picture. So it's the picture is in pieces in my lab right now, but it's being brought together and sort of revived by the presence of the temporal dynamic of learning center, where people are actually interested in time and timing. And so it's interesting from that perspective. But, yeah.
So, though I also am interested in time and timing, I want to ask you, what's known about retrosplenial cortical cells in the spatial domain? It's obviously very connected with place cell activity, grid cell activity. Do we know what?
Yeah. So actually, there are very few studies. Out of Shiri Mitsumori's lab, they've recorded place cell activity in retrosplenial cortex. For a while, the Mitsumori lab actually thought, oh my gosh, this might be the area in which the spatial map actually exists. She'd come to that conclusion, but that's not the case, actually. They don't persist over dark, and so that fell apart from that perspective. But there is place activity, actually, and there's a lot of head direction activity, which is interesting relative to our task in terms of visuomotor orienting. It gets tons of input from oculomotor areas and also from the parietal cortex as well. So it's privy to sort of self-motion space and actual oculomotor space also. The other thing that's known about that area comes from Pat Sharp, actually. And a lot of her recordings were looking at subicular place cells versus retrosplenial place cells. And unfortunately, she did one study that was beautiful and didn't go any further with it. So she sort of identified place characteristics in that region, but she didn't. And she hypothesized interesting things about different subicular connections to different areas of the retrosplenial cortex. And I won't go into that, but there's actually regional differences in connectivity from this area that are quite interesting also. We did a little bit of recording ourselves, but not systematic. We actually just dropped some wires in and decided we wanted to see what in general that region tended to fire about. And actually, we did get some interesting firing to a sequential presentation of visual objects also. But that was just basically anecdotal for our own. Can we get there? Can we get cells? And, oh, we have this for shot. Didn't expect it. Now let's try something and see what these cells do. So, yeah, they're pretty robust. It's a source separation problem, just like hippocampus, because the cells are very tightly packed in some areas of retrosplenial cortex. So you have the problem of getting too many cells instead of too few cells. So it'll require tetrode recording instead of just single wires or stereotrodes. And that makes it difficult. So any other questions? Yeah.
Just going back to the very beginning, you mentioned this Alzheimer's case, and you mentioned this task of self-ordered pointing. Could you just explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so there are two different ways. There's self-ordered pointing where you make one. There are these blocks. There are a number of ways to do this. There are these blocks, and you can decide what order to point them in, and then you point to them, in which to point to them.
So the subject decides?
Right, the subject decides, which is why it's self-ordered. And then they have to replicate that order. And then someone punches in a different order, and then they have to replicate that order, and then they have to replicate their own order, actually. And they have a deficit on this task. They actually have a deficit on the self-ordered portion and the other person ordered portion as well. It goes both ways. There was one other task that isn't published yet. It was an abstract, actually, that showed a serial reaction time task where they actually had, interesting, with humans, lights lighting up in a particular order, and the humans had to press buttons. Very similar. And early Alzheimer's patients had a problem with that. And it was so similar, and it's kind of interesting because actually the boxes that I used were originally developed for an attention task that was just a five-choice random task, and we reprogrammed them for this purpose. The original five-choice task was an animal model of the original Alzheimer's five-choice task, which was then modified to look at ordering in Alzheimer's patients. So the two have been sort of parallel. The other point I usually make at wrap-up, which I didn't come back to, was that it is possible. It's tricky to come up with animal models, and they're never perfect, but it is possible, and I think from an anatomical perspective, well worthwhile trying to test fairly complex things in animal models, because there's a lot of information to be gained by taking structures offline at a particular point in time and by recording from neurons in particular areas and multiple areas if you can to look at interactions and what information is being processed by those regions over time. So. You know, no one's looked. I mean, most regions of cortex have types of cortical LTP. Certainly frontal cortex does. I would expect that it's possible. No, actually, there's strong cholinergic projection. So cortex itself doesn't have cholinergic neurons. It has lots and lots, loads of cholinergic receptors, and it's dependent on distal structures like the basal forebrain for all the acetylcholine. Acetylcholine actually tends to be exquisitely timed with particular relevant stimuli in the environment. So you get like a dump in cortex at a particular point in time. My personal opinion is that part of the reason cholinergic therapies for Alzheimer's disease have failed is because you're just flooding the area. And in fact, the system is very temporally bound ordinarily. So if you flood the area, you get a mild effect. Like, okay, the cells are working a little better because there is some acetylcholine present, but you're not getting the temporal proximity to the stimuli appropriate. It's just flooded, basically. And so I think that's part of the reason they failed miserably. In addition to the fact that one of the little known facts that often if you remove sources of acetylcholine, a lot of the gated receptors uncouple. And so you're basically dumping something in when you can't activate the receptor because there's no G protein on it. So that's a little bit of a problem. So any other questions? Okay. Well, I hope you all enjoyed the temporal dynamics of learning sessions in total. I think you heard from several center members and have a flavor probably for what, how many, 10 of the different labs in the center are doing at this point?
Well, two people work from outside UCSD.
Oh, that's right. We would like to have them. If we had more money. Can you send this to the government? So anyway, please send money. Hopefully you have a good feel, though, for what several different laboratories are doing. I intentionally spoke about the project that's part of the center work, just so that people, students, postdocs here who are part of the center could get a flavor for what that encompasses. And actually, our rats on this particular task are not particularly cooperative right now. So we're hoping that over summer, they'll relax and get their tasks right. We've been playing with other sequence learning tasks that are pretty fun also in terms of fun rat tricks. Maybe since I have just a tiny bit of time, I'll show you one more fun rat trick. Because we would like to look eventually at memory for sequences also. So this is just a three-hole sequence. Whoops. Okay, so he's learned this fixed three-hole sequence. And now, all the lights come on at one time, and he has to remember the sequence. And so that's where we're going next, actually, behaviorally, is to actually look at replay for sequence. We haven't tried four holes. We'd like to get to slightly more holes because it gives you a lot more variability in what sequences you can present. But they can, once they learn the idea of the task, so in terms of developing animal models, the hardest problem is communicating with the animals. And then basically, with a human, you can give instructions, but with the animals, their behavior is only as good as your instructions are, right? So, you know, if you make an error, if you let a rat think it's okay to make errors for a long time, they'll make errors. You know, there's no liability to those errors. They'll make errors. So you have to remember when to institute a timeout for making an error, etc. And how to, you can't just give the rat the task and expect them to do it. You have to shape them on the task. And so, okay, we can stop this movie now. You know, yeah, we wish we could, but rats don't really have color vision. So, you know, they see the colors as slightly different, but they're more just shades of gray. Red light looks like black. You know, they can slightly discriminate between a green and a white light. Actually, that works pretty well. But, yeah, colors don't work very well. In Pam Reiningel's lab, actually, they have a touch screen going that's pretty nice. And on the touch screen, rats tend to do better in three dimensions, but they're doing okay with this 2D touch screen, and they do respond to shape pretty well. So you could get them going on different shapes, actually, also. Tim Bussey in the UK has also used shape a good deal. So anyway, so there's an example of bringing a problem for everyone into the rodent world and trying to make good of it. So I think you should all leave 15 minutes early by virtue of being this the last day of class, and we can all celebrate the last day of the quarter. And Gary can write his next papers.